Chapter 3. The 1950s vintage Rolls-Royce Silver Shadow glided along at 80 kilometres an hour, its white-walled tyres soaking up all the punishment the gritty ruts of the decrepit M11 could inflict without a hint of exertion. Julia Evans adored the old car. It was the absolute last word in style, and its rugged old-fashioned engineering was easily equal to the strength and suspension and broad silicon rubber tyres of any modern car. Apart from a closed-loop recombiner cell, which allowed it to continue burning petrol without leaking fumes into the atmosphere, and the installation of various security systems, it hadn't needed any modifications to cope with England's decaying road network. Outside the darkened glass she could see the rug of grass, weeds and lush emerald moss which had swamped the hard shoulder. Even the crash barriers along the central reservation had been swallowed up by bindweed, snow-white trumpet-shaped flowers pushing out from between the cloak of broad leaves. The original tarmac surface was still in use, scored by deep tyre ruts along each carriageway. This afternoon it was solid because of the weekend's cooling rains, but for 9 months of the year, the sun reduced the roads to swaths of mushy black treacle. The new Conservative government agreed in principle that nationwide road refurbishment should be given priority, coating the millions of kilometres of tarmac with a layer of tough thermo-cured cellulose. But they were hanging back until giga-conductor-powered vehicles became widespread before starting. The Rolls approached Junction 10, and the lead car in their four-strong police escort switched on its blue strobe lights. There seemed to be a lot of people lining the slip road.
"Who are they?" Julia asked.
Rachel Griffith, one of her two permanent bodyguards, was sitting in the jump seat opposite, a 25-year-old security division hardliner wearing a smart blue two-piece suit. She turned round, scanning the road ahead. Her lean face flashed Julia a quick, reassuring smile.
"Just some protesters," she said. "You and the Prime Minister at the same event is a publicity opportunity they can't ignore."
Julia nodded. Rachel had been with her for 5 years, tough, smart, and loyal. She liked to think of her as a friend as well. If Rachel wasn't worried, there was nothing to be worried about.
"This is as near to the Institute as they can get," said Morgan Walshaw, Event Horizon Security Chief, from the second jump seat. Even sitting, he couldn't appear relaxed, spine stiff, shoulders squared, wearing an immaculate charcoal grey suit. He fitted her conception of a crusty old retired home county's general perfectly, except Morgan was far shrewder than any general, thank God. He was 62 years old, silver grey hair clipped down to a centimetre from his skull, the thick, tanned skin of his face heavily crossed with narrow lines, hard-set, light blue eyes, which always made her feel incredibly guilty whenever he stared at her. Everything she did eventually filtered back to him. Nights out with her girlfriends in Peterborough's clubs. Holiday adventures. Party antics. Boys. Morgan had been with the company for years, protecting her grandfather, and now her, a job he performed with superb efficiency and complete devotion. His approval was always tremendously important to her, mainly because he would never make a gratuitous compliment. She had to earn it, something that never happened with most of the people in her life. And words of praise had indeed been awarded, albeit grudgingly, with more frequency in recent years. She often caught herself wishing he was her real father. The knowledge that he would be retiring in a few years was something she always tried to bury right at the back of her mind. It was a horrifying thought.
"Access roll speech," Julia told her BioWare processor node silently.
Colourless words flowed from one of the three memory nodes buried at the back of her skull, forming a ghostly script behind her eyes. She reviewed it for what must have been the 10th time since breakfast. Event Horizon's PR department had written it for her, but she'd made a few alterations. It had sounded terribly stilted before. She couldn't forget it, of course, not with the nodes reinforcing her memory, but they couldn't help her out if she stumbled over pronunciation. The rollout was going to be the technological event of the year. She couldn't afford to make a mistake. There were going to be too many people, too many channel cameras. It felt as though a squadron of butterflies were performing dynamic aerobatic routines in her stomach. The 4,000-pound sabonari suit she had chosen to wear for the ceremony was sheer silk, a bright coral pink.
The tailored jacket had a broad collar and large white buttons. Its skirt was straight, hem 5 centimeters above her knees. Sabarini was one of her favorite designers. The suit made her feel wonderfully elegant. She had decided against ostentatious jewelry, settling for her usual gold St. Christopher and a Cartier diamond brooch. Her maid had straightened her chestnut hair so that it fell down her back almost to her hips. It was a lot of trouble to condition, but after growing it for a decade, she was damned if she was going to have it cut now. Besides, a lot of girls were copying the Julia hairstyle. She had a media profile which rock stars and channel celebrities could only fantasize about. Exit roll speech. If she didn't know it now, she never would. She could hear the faint shouts of the protesters through the thick glass.
They look too well-fed to be dole dependents,
she observed, as the Rolls left the motorway, cruising past a big green and gold sign which read, Duxford, Event Horizon Astronautics Institute. A rank of police, wearing bulky navy blue riot uniforms, stood along the side of the slip road, arms linked, forming a human barricade to keep the protesters back from the little convoy. The protesters Julia could see seemed to be in their early 20s, dressed in T-shirts and jeans, most of them male. They were clean, healthy, probably students. Most of them come from colleges at Cambridge, Morgan said. Julia awarded herself a mental point. Rent-a-mob fodder, he continued. They were bussed out here this morning by a couple of radical groups, Human Frontier and the Christian Luddites. They actually get paid attendance money. Nobody would come otherwise.
Access company security file. Christian Luddites. Radical group.
She had never heard of them before. The name conjured up all sorts of amusing images. Their file squirted into her mind. Elusive data stacks she could run or hold on a whim. Not quite sight. Not quite sound. Raw neural information. The Christian Luddites claimed to be a back-to-the-earth movement, rejecting technology in all forms except for medical purposes. Security said there were possible links with ex-apparatchiks, as yet unproven. They had 15 chapters, spread around the major cities, a couple more in Europe. A detailed membership list had been compiled. She scanned the hierarchy, most of whom were involved in other small, intense activist groups. Today's radicals are a nepotistic, incestuous lot, she thought. Cancel file.
It must cost a lot of money to mount protests if you're paying attendance fees, she said. Where did it all come from originally?
We're looking into it, Morgan said. Shouldn't be allowed, said Patrick Browning, who was sitting next to her.
They're just gaining publicity at your expense.
He gave her his positive smile, the one that said he would champion her against the whole world if need be. Patrick was 21, with golden blonde hair coming down to his collar, a very handsome, angular face, deep hazel eyes that held just a hint of wickedness, and a body which any Greek god would envy. His family were wealthy, a typical European finance dynasty, with interests in shipping, construction, and medium-scale engineering, operating through anonymous Zurich and Austrian offices. So money wasn't quite so much an issue as it had been with previous boyfriends. He had just earned a business administration degree at Oxford, which gave him a nice air of self-confidence. Coming on top of his debonair mannerisms and beautifully realized sense of fun, it made him virtually irresistible. 5 weeks ago, she had been at a party when she overheard his previous girlfriend, Angela Malloy, boasting that he had the rutting stamina of a bull in springtime. Throughout the following fortnight, it seemed as though Patrick couldn't go to a party or club without bumping into Julia. It was uncanny. One might almost suspect fate was pushing them together. After he realized how many mutual interests they had, asking her for a date was only logical. And Angela had been quite right.
They have a perfect right to be there, Julia said neutrally. This country paid the most appalling price so that individuals had the right to express opinions again, however extreme or unwelcome. Only PSP apparatchiks try to oppress people for saying what they think.
She met Rachel's eye levelly, reading the meticulously contained amusement in the hardliner's composed expression. Patrick paled slightly at the rebuke, for an instant looking like a 5-year-old who had just had his chocolate bar confiscated.
"Yes," he said carefully, "but I don't like it when it's you they're expressing about."
Julia nodded fractionally. There were substantial dividends to be collected by keeping boys on their toes, unsure precisely where they stood. That way they always knew exactly who was in charge.
She leant over Patrick to get a closer look at the placards being waved. It wasn't strictly necessary. The protesters were on both sides of the slip road, but the angle would give Patrick a good view down her cleavage. She held back on a smile when she caught his eyes straying down to her neckline. Mr. Suave was no different to any of the others, Mr. Hormones in masquerade. Easy meat. She read some of the placards, the usual obscenities and crude caricatures printed in yellow and pink fluorocolours, then started to giggle.
"What is it?" Morgan asked.
He was peering out of the window.
"That one," she pointed.
A red-haired youth in a blue sweatshirt held up a kelp-board placard which said, "Julia already owns the Earth. Don't let her have the stars as well." Company security guards in immaculate grey-blue uniforms saluted sharply as they passed through the first of the Astronautics Institute's 10 gates. The police escort peeled away, leaving the Rolls to drive on to Building 1 alone. The circular structure was made up from an outer ring of offices, laboratories, design bureau, computer centres, cybernetic integration bays, and test facilities. 5 stories high, 800 metres in diameter, presenting a polished cliff face of green-silver glass to the outside world. A jet-black dome of solar collector panels roofed a central space hardware assembly hall. In the distance she could see Building 2, a twin of 1, as yet unoccupied. Contractors were busy dismantling the scaffolding. A week late, they were going to pay a hefty penalty clause for that. Architectural data constructs of Building 3 were already well advanced, big enough to put 1 and 2 inside, then rattle them around. Julia always got a kick out of the Institute. Its sheer size sprawled over the old Imperial War Museum site and now beginning to creep out towards Thriplow, was a spectacular statement of intent. Event Horizon was staking out its claim on the future for everyone to see, rekindling the old high frontier dream. There was something fundamentally exciting about commanding such a grandiose venture. Philip Evans, her grandfather, had started to build the Institute a month after the PSP fell. He believed passionately that space industry would be the catalyst in reinvigorating the country's post-warming economy. His aim was to develop a centre of excellence where every discipline of space industry could be cultivated and refined, ensuring the company had complete technological independence. Micro-G material processing had already established itself as a hugely profitable enterprise. The number of low-Earth orbit factory modules churning out wear chips, crystals, exotic compounds, and super-strength monolattice filament had grown steadily, even during the worst of the global recession, which followed the warming. But the raw materials the factories needed had to be lifted from Earth, battling against gravity throughout the whole ascent. Philip Evans's vision had the giga-conductor revolution reducing launch costs to a fraction of the chemically powered boosters, increasing profits by orders of magnitude. After that, he predicated, the exploitation of extraterrestrial resources would become economically feasible, and he was determined that as the solar system opened up, England would be the trailblazer, with Event Horizon at the forefront. Julia had inherited that faith, along with material reality. She had continued to pour money and resources into the Institute and its ambitious programs in the 2 years since he died, despite all the pressure and criticism from the company's financial backing consortium. Now the first phase of her plan was coming to fruition, after heaven alone knew how many minor setbacks and delays. Today was the day she would shut those whining know-nothings up for good. She wanted to sing and shout for the sheer joy of it. If nothing else, Patrick was in for the night of his life tonight. Building 1's vast car park was full to capacity with company minibuses and rank after rank of scooters. Private cars were still a rarity. The Rolls drove past it, and out onto the concrete desert on the other side of the building. 2 long temporary seating stands had been erected on the apron, covered from possible showers by red and white striped canvas awnings. They formed a broad avenue, leading away from Building 1's huge multi-segment sliding doors. There were 7,000 invited guests waiting for her. Institute personnel and their families, premier-grade executives from most of the combinates, channel celebrities, politicians, the Prime Minister, Prince Harry, even a few friends. A press stand had been built at the far end of the avenue. Every place was taken, which gave her a final heart flutter of nerves.
She had secretly hoped the reporters would all still be up in Scotland after the momentous weekend. Over 100 cameras swiveled round as the rolls drew up beside the VIP podium at the side of Building One's doors. Julia took a breath as the Institute's general manager scuttled forwards to open the door, then climbed out with a professional smile in place. Julia was thankful that the usual January heat was tempered by scrappy clouds and a full breeze. If it was up to her, there wouldn't even be a ceremony, but politics dictated otherwise, and the workforce needed some kind of recognition for their efforts. So she sat patiently while the bunting flapped noisily overhead, and overdressed women kept a surreptitious hand on wide hats. The Prime Minister, David Marchant, made the first speech. He was a dignified 52-year-old in a blue-grey suit, the embodiment of calm competence. He praised Philip Evans and Julia for their foresight and optimism, then moved on to the workforce and complimented their professionalism, followed up by a couple of political points against the three main parliamentary opposition groups. Julia found herself envying his delivery. He avoided rhetoric and theatrical emphasis. The words just flowed. When it was her turn, she accessed the speech and let her words glide straight from the node to her vocal cords, promising that her commitment to funding the space program remained unchanged, giving a brief outline of projects that would be initiated over the next 3 years. The larger low-Earth orbit dormitory station, expanded science program, constructing a manned asteroid survey craft, and managed to get in a joke about one of the engineering apprentices who had been strung up from a hoist by his mates a couple of months ago. She had been on an inspection tour of Building One at the time. It brought on an appreciative cheer from the section of the stands where the workers and their families were sitting. She handed over to Prince Harry for the actual rollout. He got more applause than she had. But then royalty always did. Since the Second Restoration, people saw them as a continuity jump lead to the past. They were a symbol of good times, when there was no warming and no PSP. Now they were back, and life was picking up again. Building One's doors slid open ponderously when Prince Harry pressed the button on the pedestal. Somewhat predictably, a band struck up the Zarathustra theme, and the Clark-class spaceplane emerged into the afternoon sunlight, escorted by a troop of engineers in spotless white overalls. It had a swept delta planform with a 50-metre span, 60 metres long. The metallo-ceramic hull was an all-over frost white, except for the scarlet dragonflight escutcheons on the fin. Two streamlined cylindrical nacelles blended seamlessly with the underbelly. Air scoop ramps closed, reaction control thruster clusters on the nose and around the wedge-shaped clamshell doors at the rear were masked by protective covers, removed before flight tags dangling. Julia clapped along with everyone else, impressed despite herself. The spaceplane was gigaconductor-powered, the first of its kind, capable of lifting 50 tons into orbit without burning a single hydrocarbon molecule to injure the diseased atmosphere any further. Event Horizon already had orders for 227, with options on another 300. It was an icon to the new age which the gigaconductor was ushering in. The power storage system was the ideal, cheap, easy-to-manufacture green solution to the energy problems of the post-warming world, where hostility to petrol and coal was a tangible, occasionally fatal aspect of life. And Event Horizon held the worldwide patent. Every combinate, company and state factory on the planet paid her for the privilege of manufacturing it. The royalty revenue was already over 2 billion euro francs a year, and it had only been available for 23 months. Every nation was racing to restructure their transport systems around it. She had seen artists' impressions of the commercial hypersonic jets which Combinate Aerospace divisions were developing, long, arrow-finned needles that looked like scaled-up missiles, cutting the transit time between continents to less than an hour. Car companies, those which had survived, were eager to bring out new vehicles, retooling factories which had lain idle for nearly 15 years. Scooter sales were already booming. Julia walked down the VIP podium steps, accompanying the Prime Minister and Prince Harry, lesser dignitaries trailing after them. She kept a beautifully straight face as she showed them round the spaceplane, pointing out features of interest. For once grateful for the steely discipline she had learnt at her Swiss boarding school. But it was hard.
This is the air scoop. These are the wheels. They posed under the flattened bullet nose as the press gathered for a video bite opportunity.
"I would just like to say how immensely proud I am to be here today," David Marchant told the gaggle of reporters and channel crews.
A forest of arms thrust AV recorders towards him.
"This space plane is a quite tremendous achievement by the Event Horizon Company. A clear sign that our social market policies are the right ones to put England back on its feet again. My new Conservative government wishes to demonstrate its firm commitment to the space industry by awarding Dragonflight the contract to dispose of 11,000 tons of radioactive waste. This waste is made up of the cores and ancillary equipment of redundant nuclear reactors currently being stored at great public expense around the country. And we hope that ultimately all the old reactors in this country will be broken up and disposed of in a similar fashion."
His aide stepped forward and handed him a sheaf of paper. He smiled and passed it to Julia. The contract's data work had been completed a week ago, but they had both decided to give it a high profile. The rollout was a golden opportunity. With the elections due in 2 months, it would be a valuable campaign issue for the new Conservatives, supporting industry without direct PSP-style subsidies, and showing a practical commitment to the environment. "Thank you very much, Prime Minister," she said as the reporters shouted questions. "I'll just give you a brief clarification of what the contract entails. Firstly, Event Horizon will be vitrifying the waste into 10-ton blocks in our Sunderland plant. Dragonflight will then lift them into orbit, where they will be assembled into clusters of 5 and attached to a solid rocket booster, which will launch them into the sun. This way we shall be getting rid of the waste once and for all, something I'm sure we all have cause to celebrate."
"How much is the contract worth, Julia?" someone shouted,
too loud to pretend she hadn't heard.
"As it says quite clearly in your information kit, operating costs for the Clark-class space plane work out at £400 new sterling per ton lifted into low Earth orbit. If you know anyone who can offer a cheaper price, I'm sure the Prime Minister would be interested to hear from them."
She took a pace back and turned sharp right as soon as she finished speaking, gesturing to Prince Harry and David Marchant towards Building 1. A posse of aides and management staff instinctively clustered round, isolating her. Nobody else got a chance to shout any more questions.
"Access general business."
She loaded a note to postpone the announcement about the new cyber factories for a couple of weeks. There were 18 of them, due to be built under Stage 12 of Event Horizon's expansion program, ranging from a precision machinery shop to a large-scale composite structures plant, employing nearly 35,000 people when they were complete.
"Exit general business."
It would never do for people to draw any unwarranted connections between the waste disposal contract and the siting of all 18 factories in marginal constituencies. The VIP reception was held in Building 1, a spacious rectangular lounge on the second floor. Chairs had been pushed back against one wall, leaving room for the caterers to set up their table opposite. The seafood buffet was proving popular with the guests. Waiters circulated with glasses of Moët champagne on silver trays. A loud purr of conversation was drowning out the pianist. Julia stood by the window wall, sipping some of the champagne, watching the crowd of spectators traipsing round the space plane below. It was mainly family groups, parents leading eager children, stopping to take pictures under the nose. 5 different channel news teams were recording their reporters using the space plane as a backdrop. Patrick left the buffet table and came over.
"You should eat something," he said around a mouthful of shrimp and lettuce. "I didn't think you liked fat girls," she retorted.
"I don't."
There was a gleam in his eye. She knew well enough.
"How long have we got to stay here?" "Another hour, at least. Be patient. It could be rewarding."
"Could it?"
"Yeah," she drawled. "All right." He gave her a hungry look.
She grinned back. It would have been exciting to sneak off into one of the disused offices upstairs, but there were security cameras everywhere, and experience had taught her that Rachel would never let her get out of the lounge alone.
"I suppose I'd better do my eager hostess act," she said in resignation.
Most of the people in the lounge were so much older than her, which meant she'd have to stick with small talk or business. So boring. She had seen Katerina and Antonia and Laura milling about earlier, along with their boys. But they would all be chatting to the channel celebs. She didn't fancy that either.
The silver screen magic tarnished rapidly in real life, she found. Greg and Eleanor were over on the other side of the lounge, talking to Morgan Walshaw and Gabriel Thompson, the woman he lived with. Greg looked uncomfortable and serious, but then he hated having to wear a suit and tie. She started towards them. At least she could tease Greg.
"Miss Evans!"
The urgency in the voice surprised her. It clashed with the day's mood. She turned. It was Dr. Renasfari. Julia sighed inwardly, very careful not to show any disappointment. She couldn't even make small talk with Dr. Renasfari. The tall, wiry physicist was 45 years old, neatly turned out, as always, in a light grey suit, white shirt, and a pink tie that matched her own suit's colour. His dark face looked strained, brown eyes blinking incessantly, glossed back raven hair shone a spectral blue under the lounge's bright bioloom panels. Dr. Renasfari was another of those people Julia always felt she had to impress, though she doubted many people could impress Renasfari. He was the genius in charge of the research team which had produced the Giga Conductor for Event Horizon. It had taken him 10 years, but her grandfather had never doubted he could do it.
"The man's dedicated," Philip Evans had told her once. "Bloody bore in mind, Juliet, but dedicated. That's what makes him special. He'll spend his life on a project if needs be. We're lucky to have him."
After the Giga Conductor was unveiled to the world and the need for total security was abolished, she had built Renasfari a laboratory complex in Cambridge and gave him a budget of £20 million new sterling a year to spend on whatever projects he wanted. He was currently working on a direct thermocouple, a solid-state fibre which would convert thermal energy straight into electricity, eliminating any need for conventional turbines and generators. The potential applications for geothermal power extraction alone were colossal. If he asked for £50 million a year, she would grant it.
"No drink, Cormac?"
she asked lightly. He never actually objected to her using his first name, although she was always Miss Evans to him.
"You really ought to have one glass at least. This is as much your day as it is mine."
His lips twisted nervously, showing a flash of snowy white teeth.
"Thank you, no. Miss Evans, I really must speak with you."
She had never seen him so agitated before. Her humour spiralled down.
"Of course,"
she signalled to Rachel. Julia supposed she ought to be grateful Renasfari had come directly to her. It was a silent acknowledgement of her authority. There were dozens of premier-grade executives who supervised Event Horizon's innumerable divisions, but ultimately they all answered to her. The company wasn't just hers in name. She took sole responsibility for its management, to the amazement and increasing fascination of the world at large. Responsibility, but not the burden of organization, that was shared, quietly, unobtrusively. The neural network BioWare Core was the final gamble of a dying billionaire, a bid for immortality of the mind. It had to be a billionaire. Nobody else could afford the cost. Philip Evans had spliced his sequencing RNA into the BioWare, replicating his own neuronic structure. When the NN core had grown to its full size, his memories had been squirted out of his dying brain and into their new titanium-cased protein circuitry. And it had worked. His memories operated in a perfect duplicate of his neural pathways, providing a continuation of personality. Julia had never heard the NN core utter a single out-of-character remark. It was Grandpa. He had plugged himself into Event Horizon's datanet, orchestrating the company's expansion with an efficiency far in excess of any ordinary managerial system. 70 years of experience, knowledge, and business guile put into practice by a mind with more spare processing capacity than a lightware number cruncher. No detail was too small to escape his scrutiny. Every operational aspect could be overseen with 100% attention. With him to guide her faltering steps, it was no surprise that Event Horizon had flourished the way it had. Poor old Patrick, with his dusty academic degree, could never hope to match her when it came to business tactics. In tandem with her grandfather, she made more commercial and financial decisions in a day than he would make in the next 10 years working for his family organization. And at the end of the day, she could confide in Grandpa totally. He always understood. The invisible friend of childhood imagination, upgraded for the rigours of adult life, infallible, and virtually omnipotent. It was wonderfully reassuring.
The empty office Julia and Ranasvari wound up commandeering overlooked Building One's giant central assembly hall. Even today, with half of the hall's staff attending the rollout ceremony, there was a lot of activity on the floor. Integration bays around the inner wall were brightly lit, showing white-coated technicians maneuvering large sections of machinery into place, or crowded round terminal display cubes. Little flat-top cyber-trucks followed colour-coded guidance strips along alleyways formed by bungalow-sized blocks of equipment. The space plane production line dominated the centre of the hall. The way the craft, in various stages of construction, were pressed nose to tail along its length was reminiscent of some biological growth process, Julia thought. A cyber queen's birth passage, straight out of one of those big-budget channel horror shows. At the far end were skeletal outlines, triangles of naked ribs and spars, which caged spherical tanks and contoured systems modules, coated in crinkled gold foil. As the space planes progressed down the line, sections of the metallo-ceramic hull had been fitted, the wheel bogies added, engines installed. Three almost complete craft were parked in the test bays right in front of the doors, people walking over their wings, big ribbed hoses and power cables plugged into open inspection hatches, polythene taped over various vents and inlets. Julia sat in the swivel chair behind the desk, a black imitation wood affair with an Olivetti terminal linked into a complicated CAD drafting board. The office belonged to a middle manager in the Micro-G Module Power Systems Bureau. Rachel checked it out, then closed the door behind her, standing sentry duty. Dr. Ranasvari sank into the cheap, thickly padded chair in front of the desk.
"What is it, Cormac?" Julia asked.
He gave another nervous grimace.
"Perhaps I should have gone to Mr. Walshaw, but I really feel this must be taken up at the highest level. And the Prime Minister is here. He will listen to you."
Julia moved from studious interest to outright fascination. Ranasvari never showed the slightest concern for anything outside his work. Open channel to NN Corps.
"Hello, Juliet. What's the problem? I thought you'd been enjoying yourself today,"
Philip Evans said soundlessly into her mind.
"It's Ranasvari," she told him. "I'd like you to listen in on this. I might want your opinion." "That sounds very drastic, Cormac," she said out loud. "But you know I'll help in whatever way I can."
He nodded, squeezing the knuckles of his left hand.
"Thank you.
It concerns Dr. Edward Kitchener. You know I used to be one of his students."
"I didn't know that, no. But I've heard of Edward Kitchener."
Even as she said it, she remembered. Kitchener's gruesome murder had dominated the newscasts 3 days ago, even managing to nudge Scotland off the premiere bulletins on Friday night. She couldn't remember seeing much else about it since, although there had been an update this morning, some poor detective in the hot seat, unable to satisfy the incessant questions that reporters were flinging at him.
"Grandpa, have they caught the killer yet?"
"No."
"Ah, I think I see where we're leading." "His death was a tragedy," she said hurriedly.
"Yes, and the culprit still has not been brought to justice. That is what I want, Miss Evans, justice. Kitchener was a brilliant man, brilliant. He had flaws, weaknesses, we all do. But his genius is undeniable. Simple dignity demands that his murderer is caught. I'm not asking for vengeance. I do not want the return of the death penalty, nor do I want this barbarian quietly eliminated, but I do want him caught and tried, Miss Evans. Please. The police, they've had 3 days. I'm sure they're doing their best, but after all, Oakham is just a provincial station. You must impress the Prime Minister, and through him the Home Secretary, on the absolute urgency of this case."
"Tricky one, Juliet. According to Finance Division records, we were paying Dr. Edward Kitchener for research work."
"What? I don't remember that."
"It was a contract issued by Ranasvari."
"Bloody hell."
"Damn right, girl. You start pushing Marchant for action now, and people will accuse you of meddling in police affairs. There's enough allegations about you and Event Horizon having undue influence over the new Conservatives as it is."
"What project was Dr. Kitchener working on for us?"
she asked Ranasvari. He stopped playing with his hands. "I didn't think it was worth bringing to your attention," he said evasively. She decided to go all out on the friendship routine.
"Cormac, you know you have my full confidence. That's why your budget doesn't have to be cleared through the finance division first. I don't want you having to justify yourself to accountants. I genuinely do appreciate the value of pure research."
"Seductress,"
mental laughter, echoed faintly.
"Well, thank you."
Renesfari ducked his head.
"I asked Edward to look into wormholes for me. It corresponds with his field of interest. He was quite intrigued by the prospect. We discussed a fee, but he was more interested in the specialist programs our software division could provide for his lightware processor than actual money. He agreed to take the contract, and I would channel his software requests through my laboratory. The money was just a token.
Access General Encyclopedia. Query, wormholes. Category, physics." A neat little précis emerged from the processor.
"When you say wormholes, you mean the instantaneous connections through space-time, I take it?" she asked.
"Yes. Wormholes are quite permissible under Einsteinian relativity."
"I know it's off the point, but what exactly is your interest in these wormholes?"
"I thought, Miss Evans," he said stiffly, "I thought that there might be a possible application in interstellar transit."
"A star drive?"
she said in a surprised whisper. He nodded, thoroughly miserable.
"Faster than light travel?"
Another brief nod.
"Bloody hell," said Julia.
She summoned up a logic matrix from the processor node, feeding in the relevant bytes. The combination of irrational brain and coldly precise nodes gave her an ability to dissect problems from oblique angles, fusing intuition and syllogism in a way no pure computer could match. Data packages flowed and merged through the mental construct, budding into ideas. Most she rejected. The remainder opened up interesting options.
"Who else would know that Kitchener was working for us?" she asked.
"Secrecy was not something I would wish to impose on Edward, but he was not naturally communicative. Certainly not to the media. His students would know, of course. Probably several high-level theoretical cosmologists. He maintained contacts throughout the physics community, in fact, academia in general. The free exchange of ideas is vital in such a field."
She ignored the defensive tone.
"How about it, Grandpa? Could Event Horizon be tied in?"
"You mean was he killed to prevent us from obtaining a star drive?"
"Yes."
"It's a probability, Juliet. You know it is. But I can't see anyone getting so worked up about it that they'd butcher the old boy, not for something that hypothetical. Besides, if it is possible to build an FTL star drive, then ultimately it will be built. Kitchener might have been a wild card, but plotters have their place too. I expect Renesfari could crack it if he put enough time in."
"Lord, I hope he doesn't. I rather wanted that direct thermocouple."
"What are you going to do, Juliet?"
"But we can't ignore Kitchener's murder now. If there is someone that paranoid about Event Horizon walking round loose, then I want them behind bars pronto."
"Atta girl."
She put her elbows on the desk and pressed her palms together.
"I will have Morgan Walshaw contact the Home Office directly," she said. "I think I can see how we can get this terrible crime solved quickly."
"How?"
Renesfari asked.
"The Home Office can authorize local police stations to hire specialist advisers when the circumstances warrant it."
"What sort of specialist?"
She smiled.
"I was thinking a psychic might be appropriate."